From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. When I think about neighbors, the first thing that comes to my mind is the famous line from the Bible, "Love thy neighbor as thyself." I actually looked it up because I couldn't remember who said it. You know, Jesus said it. St. Paul said it. It's in Leviticus. It's the concept known as the Golden Rule, and it exists in some form or other in every ethical system in the world. Of course, like a lot of pithy aphorisms and good advice, the devil is in the details. Would Jesus or St. Paul or even Mr. Rogers have been so keen on good neighborliness if they had to deal with the neighbor upstairs who keeps cranking her stereo up, or the screaming kid next door, or that guy with the barking dog? This hour, stories about the neighbors.
Please won't you be my neighbor? Welcome to this neighborhood, neighbor.
So maybe Mr. Rogers was right, and every neighbor is a potential friend, someone worth inviting over, getting to know. On the other hand, maybe the weird guy next door will turn out to be Jeffrey Dahmer. That's what actually happened to the artist and alternative cartoonist Dirf Backdurf. He grew up in the 1970s in the small town of Richfield, Ohio, and among his circle of friends was a kid everyone knew as Jeff. Jeff Dahmer. Not a serial killer or a cannibal yet, just a weird kid with some problems. Backdurf writes about his former neighbor in a graphic novel called My Friend Dahmer. Steve Paulson asked him to take us back to July 22nd, 1991, the day we all found out about Jeffrey Dahmer's crimes.
Put yourself in my place. You know, you go through your adolescence. I can't say that I enjoyed it, but it was a very typical kind of goofball adolescence, nothing that was really too horrible. And then with the flick of a switch, suddenly that entire era is completely redefined in an utterly chilling, sinister way as you realize that you had this fiend, emerging fiend, winding his way through your personal history. So I had a lot of things going on to deal with. Psychologically, I suppose, is the best way to put it.
Your book is called My Friend Dahmer. How close a friend were you?
Well, that's what the book is about. He wasn't what I would call part of my inner circle, but we were, me and my friends, were probably as close to friends as he had. I mean, this was a kid who was missing chunks of his humanity from a very early age.
Did you realize that at the time?
Oh, yeah.
So there's something just really odd about him, weird.
Yeah, right from the beginning. Yeah, absolutely. And we're talking, I mean, I met him when we were 12, so and continued our friendship up until we were 18. And 2 weeks after our high school graduation, he killed his first victim here in Ohio.
But that didn't come to light until years later.
Until years later, right. But we were very, very close to that. I mean, you know, within a couple hundred yards of that, really. That's, I mean, it's things like that are the things that I really had the most trouble dealing with.
So you said it was always obvious that this guy was really strange. What did he do that was so different?
Well, he didn't relate to people the way other people would. I mean, you know, from the very beginning, he was probably the loneliest kid that I'd ever met. Later on, he began to act out. I assumed it was a way to interact with people because he started to get attention for it. And, you know, it sort of steamrolled from there. He would fake epileptic fits in the mall or in school. He would pretend he had cerebral palsy. He bleated like a sheep in class. And it sounds terrible, but keep in mind we were 15 years old and bored to death, and anything out of the ordinary was both fascinating and amusing.
So he was going for laughs. He was trying to get a rise out of the kids around him.
Absolutely. And then later, and this I reflect in the book becomes darker and darker, and more claustrophobic as it unfolds. His behavior became darker, and particularly the drinking. He was a heavy drinker. Mainly he was self-medicating, trying to quell these hideous urges that were just taking him over.
The way you depict this in your book, I mean, it's shocking how much he drank. I mean, apparently he came in to school totally plastered.
Yeah. He would walk around the halls of the school with a styrofoam coffee cup from a coffee machine in the cafeteria. It was full of scotch or whiskey, you know, some dark liquid that looked like coffee, walking right through the halls of the school. Now, keep in mind, this is a very different era, and I try to get that across in the book that, you know, it was not 2012. I mean, it was 1978, 1977. It was a completely different society, completely different era, but still, that's a little hard to explain away.
Yeah, it's a little unbelievable when you say there are times when he was passed out, literally, on the school grounds. I mean, how could no adult actually see this?
Right. Yeah, I have no explanation for it. Either they didn't care or, you know, they didn't want to be bothered. And by the time that it got really bad, he was already a senior, and they figured, well, you know, in a couple months, he'll be somebody else's problem. Well, he was somebody else's problem. And it is a very tragic and troubling element of this story. And one of the reasons I find it so fascinating and wanted to get it down is that it's really unbelievable that he got away with what he got away with. Now, he had a skill for that, which he employed with very lethal effectiveness later in life, as you well know.
Why do you think he was drinking so much?
I believe that he was self-medicating, and this is what Jeff himself says. I mean, he didn't feel that he could approach anyone else about what was going on in his head. I mean, how do you go up to someone and say, hey, you know, I'm fantasizing about dead bodies? You know, that's not going to happen. And he was trying to, anyway, just you know, tamp down these horrible urges that were in his head and virtually threatening to take him over body and soul. And this was what he came up with. And for a while, I mean, in the book, you know, I think it was almost a heroic struggle. I know that people have trouble attaching that word to Jeffrey Dahmer. But remember, the Dahmer that I knew had committed no crime. He was just this horribly troubled kid marching inexorably toward the abyss as the adults in his life failed to intercede. And, I mean, put yourself in his shoes. Where would he go? That's what he came up with.
You mentioned that you were part of something called the Dahmer Fan Club. What was that?
It was this small group of band nerds, my inner circle. There was maybe five or six of us. And we, for a while, pulled him into our circle and encouraged him to act up and act out. Of course, it was all meant in jest. You know, I've been criticized periodically that, you know, we were cruel or dismissive of him. And that's not really the case. I mean, Dahmer himself remembered that time very fondly. It was very likely the happiest time of his life because he had friends and he was the center of attention in a good way. I mean, as good as it got for him anyways.
You write about one episode when you basically egged him on to act out, to do his thing in a shopping mall.
Right. We paid him like $35 to put on a command performance, we called it. And it was an epic, legendary afternoon, yeah. But then his behavior got so dark that eventually we just, one by one, just pushed him away.
Just to follow up on that one incident, what happened that afternoon?
He walked around the mall throwing various epileptic fits, you know, bleeding at people. He knocked over glasses of water at a restaurant and pretended he was having fits, that sort of thing. As we followed him around in a large pack of 10 or 12 teenagers laughing and cackling, and he got away with it. And that was pretty much all that happened that day. You know, looking back on it, even at that time, by the end of the day, I was pretty creeped out. And that was actually kind of the end of my time with him, because after that, I distanced myself from him.
What was it that creeped you out about him?
Well, the drinking, first of all, which I saw firsthand. He downed an entire six-pack of beer on the way to the mall in the space of about 6 or 7 minutes.
He drank six cans of beer in 6 minutes?
Yeah. It just made my skin crawl watching it in the rearview mirror. And that was it really came into focus for me just how troubled this kid was at that point. And so I pushed him away. And, you know, people have called me out on that. And there are no heroes in my story. I mean, everybody fails, including, of course, Jeff himself. But I'm not going to apologize for pushing him away because instinctively, that was a pretty darn good instinct to have. It could have well been me cut up in the trunk of his car a couple weeks later. So I'm not going to apologize for that, but it certainly was the last kind of shove toward what awaited him.
Yeah. So on the one hand, you could say, well, he was dealt a really bad deck of cards, and as we said, his home life was a mess. He couldn't connect with people. He was the people around him, the society around him failed him, and yet when you look at the crimes, I mean, later, rape, dismemberment, necrophilia, sure, cannibalism, I mean, that sounds like insanity.
Well, it sure does. My view, I think I laid this out pretty clearly, is that once he starts to kill, I lose all sympathy for him. I mean, to some degree, he chose to give in to these urges and become the monster that we all know. And at that point, the only tragedy is that he just didn't have the courage to put a gun to his head and end it because, I mean, what did he have to live for? The book itself does not portray a sympathetic portrait of Dahmer the monster. This is Jeff, the kid that I knew. This is the story before that story, and it, you know, it's important to clarify that.
Now, there are some very chilling scenes in your book. One of them is you talk about a friend, your friend Mike, who mm-hmm. had given Dahmer a ride home in his car. And right. apparently, based on the timeline that you reconstructed, you figured out that the body of Dahmer's first victim was probably buried just yards away from...
In garbage bags, just yards away.
Yeah, garbage bags.
Yeah. Unburied, yeah.
When you think back on that, I mean, were you in danger?
Well, we have talked about that. I take comfort somewhat in knowing that he never killed people that he knew, only strangers, like most serial killers. But, you know, who knows? I mean, if he had snapped, especially that first murder, that was just total impulse. You know, he didn't plan anything. It wasn't like the other murders where he stalked people. This was just some kid he picked up near the mall who was trying to hitch his way home. And it's, you know, just the randomness of it is just so troubling. It's the old warning from your mother. Don't hitchhike. You'll be picked up by a serial killer. Well, this kid was. Dahmer just lost control for a second, and within minutes, he was a monster. He had killed. And could that have happened to any of us? Well, you know, who knows? I'm glad I didn't have a chance to find out.
In 1994, a few years after Dahmer was arrested, he was beaten to death by an inmate in prison.
Right.
How did you feel when you heard about that?
You know, I was actually kind of surprisingly upset by that. I had not been in contact with Jeff. I never made an attempt to reach out to him. But at that time, he was only the second high school friend that I had lost, so I guess that's somewhat understandable. And then, you know, I was kind of upset that I was upset, and so why am I mourning this guy in any way? But, you know, personal relationships are hard to explain away easily sometimes.
You've said that once Dahmer killed, once he claimed his first victim, then mm-hmm. your sympathy totally goes out the window. I mean, you know, right. he's crossed the line. He's beyond the pale.
Sure.
But before that, were you trying to sympathize with him? I guess the question is, what were you trying to do with this book? Were you trying to humanize Jeffrey Dahmer?
Oh, absolutely. As I said, the Jeff that I knew had committed no crime. He was not an inhuman monster. He was a person who had inhuman urges, but he certainly was not a monster. And I think that there are lessons there to be learned. Well, maybe not lessons, but it certainly is a cautionary tale. And I don't think we do ourselves any favor when we just write these people off as monsters, because there's a certain inevitability that comes with that. You know, oh, he was a monster. It was inevitable that it happened. Well, I don't think it was inevitable. I think if somebody had acted, if somebody, particularly an adult, had gotten this kid, red flagged this kid, gotten him some help, that maybe some of this could have been stopped. Maybe not. Maybe it was inevitable, but it sure would have been nice if somebody had tried.
Derf Back Derf, talking with Steve Paulson about his graphic novel, My Friend Dahmer. To read an excerpt from the novel, visit our website at ttbook.org. You know, a few weeks ago, we asked you to send in your own neighbor stories. Stories about neighbors who've challenged or surprised you in some way. Kim Duffy called us from Utah with this story.
We've lived adjacent to 3 acres of woods and pastures for 25 years. And our neighbors were rabbits and pheasants and fox and deer and an 85-year-old gardener whom we loved. When he died, the man who purchased the property drove up in an orange Hummer. Now, I drive a Prius, and my husband drives an old pickup truck, so we were a little nervous about what was about to happen to this property. We started early on just calling him Neighbor because we didn't know his name. As the months have gone on, what has panned out is that he's building a 24,000-square-foot home. His 8-car garage now wraps around our vegetable garden and our compost bins, and the house just looms up over us and kind of creates an echo in our property now. In the beginning, we had a few flashpoints with this fellow. His workers tore out some cattle fencing, which is the historic and legal property line, so we called him immediately and told him about it, and he had the workers there the next morning to put the fence back up. And as I said from the beginning, we decided that despite the fact that we don't have anything in common with him, we wanted to get along with him. We decided that we'd rather be happy than be right. So when he he shared with us the fact that he's spending $800,000 on his landscaping. Our house and 2 acres are all maintained by my husband and I. And we like to leave a lot of unattended woods and bracken for the quail and the owls that we hear from the spruce trees at night. So this March, we had half of our driveway pulled up. And for the first time, we hired landscapers to plant a bank of mature evergreens to obscure the vision of his house. Last week, neighbor asked me if we wanted a gate installed in this 300-foot-long fence he's installing on the other side of our trees. And I thought about it for a moment, and I said, yes, we would like a gate, because I would rather have a conduit to a neighbor rather than a blank wall separating me from an enemy.
That's TT Book listener Kim Duffy with a story about her neighbor. Kind of makes you think about that Robert Frost line, good fences make good neighbors. I'm Ann Strainchamps. You're listening to the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're telling stories about neighbors in this hour, the good, the bad, the indifferent. Our intern, Nayantara Mukherjee, grew up in Bombay, India, and all summer long she's been telling us stories about the unusual interactions she had with her neighbors there, like this one, the case of the disappearing cat.
So my maid, Joan, was absolutely convinced that the neighbors had stolen our cat. Coco was the kind of cat who never left home. We could keep the door wide open, and she would just walk past with an air of indifference. We used to call her a reverse Buddha, because you could keep the door to the palace open all day, and she would just never leave. And my neighbors just absolutely loved her. They made every excuse to come see her. They would borrow salt. They would borrow sugar. They would borrow oil. And even after the rest of us had all given up on ever finding her again, Joan was just absolutely sure it was the neighbors, and she was not going to go down without a fight. So now most people would have a ruse to go over to their neighbors and search the house, see if they could find the cat. But not Joan. Joan had a completely different method. She went over to the neighbor's house one morning and just started chatting with the neighbors, you know, about the weather, about what was going on. And inevitably, the conversation went to the cat, because by this time it was the talk of the neighborhood. Everybody was wondering where the Mukherjee's cat had gone after 10 days. They were talking, and the neighbor asked, oh, so have you found the cat yet? And Joan said, no, but I'm absolutely sure we're going to find it by the end of this week. I have no doubt at all. And the neighbor was a bit taken aback, and she said, how do you know that you're going to find the cat by the end of the week? And Joan said, oh, it's very simple. I just went to a tantric priest, and I had him put a spell on whoever has the cat. And he promised me whoever has the cat is going to die by the end of this week unless we get that cat back. The very next day, my neighbor fell ill. I don't know why. She wasn't extremely sick, but she was clearly unwell. And then the very next morning at 3 a.m., there was a loud knocking on our door. And so my sister stumbled groggily out of bed. She went and opened the door. Who's staring down our door at 3 a.m.? And there it is. It's the neighbor. And she says, it's Coco. I found Coco. And my sister says, where's Coco? And she says, look across in the building across the way. She's hiding in the bushes there. And it's 3 a.m. in the morning. Sure enough, from the bushes, she hears this really soft, plaintive mew. And so she rushed out of the house, ran to the bushes, and the minute she got close enough, Coco just ran into her arms, and she was home. And she's been home ever since. So we'll never really know where she was for those 10 days, and we'll never really know if the neighbor stashed her there at 3 a.m. out of fear of tantric reprisal. And we'll never really know why our otherwise friendly Coco hisses and hides when the neighbor comes by. But I do know this. Whoever that fictional tantric priest was, I want his number.
Nayantara Mukherjee spent this summer interning for To the Best of Our Knowledge. She will be leaving us soon, and we will miss her and her stories. So a neighbor is a person who lives near you, right? Like maybe in the apartment or the house next door, down the block. But what about someone who doesn't have a place to live? Like, what about the homeless guy who sleeps in a doorway down the street? Is he your neighbor too? And if so, how will you treat him when he knocks on your door? Our next story is about the complicated relationship that developed between a nationally celebrated artist and a homeless man. Charles Dwyer is a painter and a graphic artist. His work is in museums and galleries all around the country. He lives in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in an old warehouse district, the kind of place that's home to both indie artists and street people. And a few years ago, he noticed a homeless guy hanging around, a guy named Jerry File. One day, Jerry asked him for money, and Charles gave him $5. And this went on for a while. Jerry would ask for a handout. Charles would give him a few bucks. And then one day, Charles did something unusual. He asked if Jerry would like to make some art.
First of all, I wanted him to keep a sketchbook, just a simple sketchbook, like the daily life of someone who lives on the street. No, was the answer. I'm not carrying this around. I'm not writing it. And I can see why. After witnessing his lifestyle, it was not something he wanted to do. So I was setting up my etching press, and I said, well, do you want to work on some copper plates and do some etching, which is a very raw process? What you see is what you get, kind of a thing, kind of like Jerry. And
but I want to interrupt for a sec.
Sure.
But so as far as you know, this is a homeless guy who makes his living scavenging for cans. You're an internationally renowned artist. Your work's in galleries all over the world. Mm-hmm. What made you think he'd have any interest or be able to make art? I mean, had he ever drawn anything?
No, I've asked that question. I said, have you done any drawing or any of that? And he's like, well, not since grade school. And then I asked, well, what do you like to draw or what did you draw? And, oh, you know, the basic things like trees and whatever he could remember from his childhood.
So the next thing you do, you're asking him in if he wants to work on some copper etchings?
Yes, but I know it was, but I love like brute art and naive work, and perhaps what can I do in my own work that he could bring and show me in a sense. So the first plate was ready, gave him the tool, kind of a needle, and you scratch into this coating and it exposes the copper and then you etch it. So the first one was kind of raw and naive, but I liked it. And then the second one we did.
So there are a bunch of really interesting, edgy, I guess, ethical and personal kind of issues here. Like
it is. It's a psychiatrist's dream, I'm sure. You know?
Well, so, I mean, was this your Pygmalion fantasy? Were you, wanting to turn him into this amazing kind of art brute discovery?
Kind of. In all honesty, how it started is started like the third or fourth print, and I was really liking it. And then I'm like, okay, what can I do? And so I saw the South Shore Water Frolics had an ad in the paper. And so I'm like, okay, this could be interesting. So my deviant plan, in a sense, was to do this series of etchings from this homeless guy, which were very kind of brute, beautiful though, and I framed them very blue chip, better than I've seen my work framed, for example, and 8-ply mats and gold frames with the prices deemed ridiculously high. We even thought about videotaping it and having a camera in the tent and just to catch people's reactions. So it started out as kind of a, not to degrade anyone, but just to kind of maybe degrade the art world, for example, and its process of who makes it and who doesn't.
So now you're taking your art experiment and you're turning it into kind of a piece of performance art and a commentary on the art world. At some point, didn't you think, am I using this guy?
Oh, yeah, definitely. But here's how it did turn out. I would pull an impression, and I could see him get up and want to see how it looked. Okay, so I knew for once he was proud of what he did. And at that point, I was like, I can't do this. I'm not going to do this kind of spoof to the art world thing. And really respected the work as good, you know. And then I just had the show up. I had all not for sale. I wasn't even selling the work. I just had it, spent a lot of money, framed it, presented it, and people liked it. Graham Reed, who is an assistant at the museum, he saw the work at the South Shore Water Frolics and loved how it was presented, loved the way it looked. And then they pick a Wisconsin artist and show them for a duration of time. And so Jerry was chosen. So it was good. But like your question of like, was I ever using him? You know, there was like this sincere manipulation to get the best product I could get out of there. And I like to work. And when he was there, I made sure he worked.
It sounds like there was a moment of transformation. There was a moment there where maybe you were heading toward using him and something changed and you started seeing him, what, as an artistic equal, peer?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And eventually we got him into the Salvation Army. That was another goal of mine. How can I help him, not mainstream him, but how can I help him? And when I saw him take appreciation in what he was doing, I knew I had a chance at least, you know? So as I find out, you can't help people unless they help themselves, you know?
That fell apart?
That did. After almost 90 days, being clean, clean clothes, a roof over his head, to getting caught smoking on the roof of the Salvation Army and being kicked out. The night he got kicked out, it was cold. It was like 5 degrees. And there's a knock on my door, and it's Jerry. The next day now is our art opening at the Wisconsin Museum of Art, and he was drunk.
So when he showed up at your house,
yeah.
What did you do? Did you invite him in, let him stay overnight?
Oh, man, I was disappointed. Yes, he stayed. We kind of kept him almost quarantined. It's like, Jerry, we have this show tomorrow. People are under the assumption that your life has been turned around and you're doing well. It was easy to write the story that way. And it's spinning out of control. No. But so we do the show and everyone is under the impression that he's doing well. He felt terrible that day. I know he did. He said it to me many times. But, you know, after a long period of time, got him back into Salvation Army, and then he was kicked out again. And from that point now, he's just been doing what he's always been doing. Hmm.
But in the meantime, his work has sold, right?
It has. It's gotten to the point where, you know, there's a body of his work at the Iron Horse Hotel in Milwaukee. His work has sold. But the deal was, like, if we sold a print, the deal was you get half.
How much does his work sell for?
I think the highest prices for the prints I was selling was $400. Here's what happens. I sell the print, so I give him $200 cash. He'd be gone for weeks. So that was hard to get. I mean, giving him a chunk of money. So I'd rather not sell them. And I'm very reluctant to sell anything because I don't want to be the caregiver, you know? And I don't want to be his banker. And I don't want to be any of those things that have to keep him responsible.
So, I mean, I have a sense of what you got out of all of this. What do you think Jerry's gotten out of this experience?
You know, on many occasions, still, when are we going to do some art? When are we going to do some art? You got anything for me? Are we going to do some art? He enjoys it. Either he enjoys being in my house, being able to sit down and drink beer and listen to music and be off the street, or actually making something and looking at it. He asks questions like, well, where's those one gun paintings we made? Or where are those? I've had offers up to, $3,000. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to sell it. Now to Jerry, that's completely absurd. You know, he looks at me as like, let's make money making this work. Like, this is going to make me famous. This is going to get me everything I want. And, you know, it could, provided if he would do it on his own, you know, but it's not going to happen. It won't happen. It's integral where we both need each other, but at the same time, what we make is dangerous. And beautiful.
artist Charles Dwyer talking about his relationship with Jerry File. You can see some of the art they made together on our website at ttbook.org. You know, a few weeks ago we asked you to send us your stories of unforgettable neighbors. Here's one from Wisconsin listener Donna Yearling.
So the good news is my neighbors are selling their house, but the bad news is my neighbors are selling their house. And to tell the truth, I think the house is being offered a slightly lower price because the couple in question is going through a divorce. Not that it was a long planned out thing. I actually don't think they even talked about it. Instead, the wife waited until her husband left for his third shift job, loaded up the contents of the house, and just left. I guess she even took the shower curtain. They had a guy living in their basement. He'd be there on and off for long stretches of time. His name was Bobby. I called him Bobby in the Basement. Bobby in the Basement could get into my house with a credit card. I discovered that tidbit when I got locked out one day. I just replaced doorknobs and had them set the lock automatically. The next day, my friend closed the back door on his way out, and we were stuck. So we walked next door to borrow a screwdriver in hopes of removing a screen. Bobby was the only one home. He couldn't find a screwdriver, but said he could get in if we had a credit card. I figured there was no way in hell he'd be able to beat the new doorknob lock setup. The hardware wasn't cheap after all, besides Bobby in the Basement had one of his arms in a sling. But I didn't have a better plan, so my friend gave him a credit card, and we started the short walk to my place. On the way, Bobby's phone rang, so instead of letting it go to voicemail, he answered the call and continued the conversation while he went to work on the door. I'm not exaggerating when I say it took him less than 2 minutes to get the door unlocked, seriously, with his arm in a sling and cradling a cell phone. It was unbelievable. I doubt he had a credit card of his own, but to be on the safe side, I put deadbolts in the next day. Another fun story about Bobby in the Basement is the time he put a ladder against my house in the middle of the night. It was raining, and I guess my gutters were clogged, which caused water to flow over the sides and into his basement lair. I never heard a thing, but they told me about it the next day. Can you imagine if I would have looked out my bedroom window on a stormy night to see someone climbing up a ladder? Good night. Apparently, Bobby was making quite a few late-night trips out of the basement. Turns out he was fooling around with the lady of the house while her husband was working the night shift. I imagine she and Bobby are living in someone else's basement now, crowded in with the contents of her former house, making sweet, sweet love on a shower curtain.
That's TT Book listener Donna Yearling. Have you got a story about an unforgettable neighbor? Someone who surprised or challenged or even taught you something? You can share it on our Facebook page. I'm Ann Strainchamps. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Sometimes a new neighbor can be like a surprise package from fate. A gift you didn't ask for, you weren't expecting, and you might even prefer to return unopened. But sometimes the eccentric, odd, even challenging neighbor turns out to be one of the best things that ever happened to you. Alexander Masters had an experience like this. He's a writer who lives in Cambridge, England, in a house with one of those downstairs basement apartments. And the neighbor in that basement is named Simon. He's this tall, shambling recluse. He lives in the dark on a diet of tinned kippers and ramen mix, and he's obsessed with bus timetables. He's also one of the greatest mathematical prodigies of the 20th century. Masters wrote a wonderful book recently about his brilliant neighbor. It's called Simon, The Genius in My Basement. When he and Jim Fleming sat down to talk, they began with a reading from the book.
Schlush, dunk, dunk, schwap, dunk, schwap. Listen, can you hear? Dunk, schlish, dunk, swap, swap, dunk. Bend down. Put your ear against the carpet. schwap, dunk, 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 schwap, dunk, schlish, lish, dunk, 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 schwap, dunk, schlish, dunk, dunk, schwap, schlish, dunk. That's the sound of a once-in-a-generation genius. Simon Phillips Norton. Phillips, with an S, as if one Philip were not enough to contain his brilliance. He lives under my floorboards. Dunk, dunk, dunk. There's another very important sound, which is too difficult to represent typographically. An intermittent, twisted crackle, sharp but thick, with a strong sense of command, resting on a base of plosive disorder. It's the sound of plastic bag being opened in a hurry and the gratification of discovering important papers inside. Without understanding this noise, you cannot understand the man. Schlish dunk, schwap, schwap, dunk, dunk. Simon has been pacing down there for 27 years, 3 months, 5 days, 13 hours, and 8 minutes. Shh. Stop breathing. Did you catch that? Still another sort of noise. A sort of sigh. That was a thought.
What an extraordinary neighbor you have had.
Yes, he was quite remarkable. Well, he still is. He's still my neighbor.
What did you know of him when you moved there?
Very little. He was the odd fellow on the street. I knew that, and I'd seen him about on the streets, wandering about, you know, with his wild hair and his torn trousers and his shoes quite often flapping, and he always had this bag. And this slightly glazed look in his eyes, but I knew very little about him. He seemed fairly amiable. Pleasant sort of bloke, but I didn't know much about his background at all.
You weren't worried at all about it. This was a slightly odd man, but after all, you weren't going to be living with him just in the same house.
No, I wasn't worried about him at all. I mean, he's obviously completely harmless and nice enough. I'd said hello to him a couple of times on the streets, and he charged a very, very decent rent for this room, and it was a pleasant room, and I liked it because he wasn't going to be one of those sort of ghastly interfering landlords who would sort of try and introduce you to their family or something like this. You know, he was just going to let you be, and you'd get on with it, and he'd get on with whatever he was doing. So he seemed to me a perfectly genial and pleasant person to have, you know, to be paying a little bit of money to every week.
How long did it take before you began to realize that there was more to him than a slightly pleasant man who was your landlord?
As anyone, as always happens when you get a peculiar-looking character in a street, there are rumours going round that he was a frazzled-out genius and these dreadful things had happened and his life was a terrible disappointment. Or, you know, there was some sort of fable that was going on around in the streets about him, and particularly in a city like Cambridge, where there are quite a lot of people who looked like Simon. And for each of them, there is a little set of anecdotes that builds up a little myth about them. So I heard those, and that they had to do with maths immediately intrigued me. So then I started to ask him about that. He's a man completely without vanity and no desire to boast about himself at all. But it turned out that he wasn't just any old mathematician. He was, at his peak, really the greatest thing England had. So I was immediately in awe of him and delighted to find that I was a tenant in the house of such a man. But I didn't think at that point of writing anything about him, partly because writing about mathematics is famously the way to end all chances of book sales. But then I thought, for goodness sake, you know, the stuff he works on, he works in an area of mathematics known as group theory. I won't go into that now, but it's a fairly simple area to sort of to understand the basic elements. But the special area he worked on was a group. It's a measure of symmetry, a type of study in mathematics. And it was monstrously difficult and monstrously large. So it was known as the monster group. Well, that was quite an intriguing phrase, and I liked that. And then he worked on a special area of it that had some particularly unexpected consequences, because it had seemed like a very abstract and an area of mathematics that had no practical application at one time. Suddenly, this stuff, apparently out of nowhere, had practical applications right at the fundamental layers of physics. And so they called that moonshine. And so the area he worked in was called monstrous moonshine. And I thought to myself, I don't care what that is, someone has to write about it. That is so good, that title.
I can see exactly why you would find that so appealing. But at the same time, there must have been at least a part of your mind that said, first, can this possibly be true? This is such a good story that it sounds as though someone made it up. And then the temptation must also have been to focus not on the mathematician, but on the eccentric.
Oddly enough, when I first started writing the book, no one thought of it as an interesting story. Everyone said, I don't believe you can possibly write a book about Simon. It's not possible. He has so little interest in the resonant phrase. He has very little sort of sense of romantic anecdote, romantic in the old-fashioned sense, you know, of having a good dramatic element to it. He's just not material for a book because he doesn't take joy in the sort of things that you want the hero of a book to take joy in. And there were people who were saying to me, you know, I find it difficult to meet Simon because, and these would be mathematicians saying this to me, he represents to me such a display of failure. Here was this man who was at one point the top of every aspiration as far as a mathematician goes, and now is at the bottom. You know, he's this disheveled character living in your basement whose principal interest is now buses and trains. Why would you want to write about this person?
But, you know, when I hear you talk about this, it suddenly strikes me that that's exactly why you can. You talk about how people have difficulty reading about mathematics and being interested in mathematics. And in some ways, Simon is exactly the kind of person we want to introduce us to it, because our memories, for most of us, even those of us who loved mathematics, was of the brain drain that went into memorizing multiplication tables when we were seven. Whereas Simon really spoke math, didn't he? Almost
yes.
Out of the womb.
Well, and the great pleasure I found in speaking to him and getting, he's terribly, terribly generous as well. He was always, you know, I would bumble along trying desperately to understand the basic elements of his subject and fail. And he would begin very straightforwardly over again with a slightly different set of images to try and let me understand that way. And the thing I found about him in his discussion of his upbringing as a mathematician is actually the sort of maths that you and I might have found hard work at school. It didn't interest him in the slightest, to be honest. He found that very dull, clunking through those sort of endless algebraic proofs. His whole attitude to maths was you had a result. There was some sort of result, which may have been a result the teacher had set you to prove, let's say. You wanted to find 15 ways of getting there, not just one, not just the boring one of going through all that algebraic stuff. You wanted to find images. You wanted to find metaphors. You wanted to find odd connections with other types of ways of representing numbers. And you might dream them up on the spot. And they might hold for a little bit, just hold sufficiently for you to establish some connection that made this answer a necessary result. What didn't interest him is the sort of memorizing of timetable stuff that certainly, when I was a child, that's what I was forced to do, and quite rightly, I needed to learn my times tables, but I didn't have that spark, that artistic spark that made Simon so distinctive as a great mathematician.
You know, I like that. I like that you call him an artist, because I think that may help us to move to the other Simon, the Simon who no longer cares about maths, at least not in that way, but does care, and I guess his obsession with transportation is actually a form of artistry, isn't it? He's interested, he looks at it and sees it as a problem that deserves to be solved.
Yes, and I think for him, the idea of a sort of sense of completeness, of a neatness, of a structure that works is what really, I think for Simon there is a great sense of a neatness, of a structure that it isn't neat yet, and it ought to be made neat. And so he's constantly firing off letters to politicians and saying, look, you should do this in a different way. And he's usually right. You know, he's figured out some much better way to do things.
Part of what I like about that, I have to confess, is that the immediate response to someone like Simon is to suggest that he is, autism is a word that would be applied often to that. But
I mean, after speaking to Simon, getting to know him well, I decided I was not going to mention the word autism in the book. I'm sick of the word autism. People are just bandied about all over the place. Now, I have no doubt that it is often correctly bandied about, but people are starting to boast about it. You know, I'm a bit autistic, they'll say at some supper party, and they say, no, you're not. You're just either a bit boring or a bit weird, but you're not autistic. You know, autism is a proper illness, and people who have autistic children, that is a hard thing to deal with. And so it's become a kind of a facile word to use. Well, in Simon's case, if he is, it's not interesting, really, because in what way does it advance you to an understanding of Simon? If it doesn't, it takes you away from an understanding of Simon, because if you try and understand Simon as someone who has an enormous talent that, you know, and you want to have some sense of what it feels like to have that talent or what it feels like to lose that talent, because that was the particular thing that interested me with Simon. I think there are many books written about geniuses, but not many about the loss of genius. What does it feel like to have a sense of something being taken from you? Then to place him already in a distant category is not going to help. Mm. And I think also with someone like Simon, how can you tell? I mean, he grows up from the age of 3, well, 1.5, but I mean, by the time it became very evident, 3 or 4,
he's already finding it difficult to speak to the kids around him because he thinks so much quicker than they do. He has so many things to delight him that they don't. I mean, they will be playing with balls and stuff like that, but he's got this intellectual delight that they don't yet have. By the time he's 15, there's no one in the whole town he can talk to because none of them is up to him. But imagine being a child who feels so isolated from his peers. Of course he's going to grow up weird.
Yeah.
Is he odd as a consequence of his genius, or is he odd as a consequence of some boring thing like autism, which, as I say, I'm not terribly interested in? I don't think you can pick it out. I think this is just Simon. It's Simon as he grew up in this odd situation with this incredibly rare talent.
Now, the other thing he has, of course, is a biographer who did get interested in him, not in the oddity of him, but in him. You really have gotten to know him, haven't you?
Yes, well, I've known him now for probably 15 years. When was it I moved in? In the mid-90s. Mid-late 90s I moved in there. So it was about 15 years, I'd have thought. And, you know, he was a very pleasant landlord. He was not interfering. I would have various parties and invite him up to the parties, and he'd come up. And he has this quite odd manner if you have a party and there's everyone standing about. And he's a lot better at it now, but he used to be a bit odd about how he'd approach someone if there was a group he wanted to talk to. He couldn't quite figure out how to get involved in the conversation. So what he'd do is he'd come up with an enormous bus timetable. He'd run downstairs to his basement, pick up this enormous bus timetable and open it up. And so his finger was resting in the middle of the enormous timetable and then wait for the conversation. And he'd inch up to this group of conversationalists, inch up to it with a bus timetable at the ready, and then wait for the name of a town to pop up. And he'd quickly find it in the bus timetable, leap into the conversation and say, yes, there's a bus going there. And then he'd tell you about. Now, that allowed, because he just couldn't figure out how to do it. Once in the conversation, he was fine. And it was just the introducing himself to the conversation that went through this odd way.
So, you know, I can hear the smile in your voice. There's a smile in your voice as you describe this, but I'm left with a wonder if you didn't worry about it a little when you first invited him to a party. This is not the way most people engage in conversation.
No, but on the other hand, there was no aggression in it. It was perfectly clear that there was no sort of underlying current going on. You know, he was being absolutely, this is the way he did things. He wasn't trying to disguise anything. He wasn't trying to say something on the sly. He was being obviously very straight in Simon's way of being straight. And you just appreciate that instantly. And everyone would say at the end, you know, who is that weird but really lovely man? It was so nice. Because I think also just to find someone who, I mean, for me, the word that always accompanies Simon is a sense of delight. And the enthusiasm of him for whatever has taken his fancy is so nice to see, because it's not tempered in any way. It's not tempered by some sort of attempt to swagger or show off or be sophisticated. No, he just, if he likes a thing and he feels enthusiastic about it, he goes for it.
You and Simon get along very well. You've become friends. What is it you think that makes you friends?
I find, to me, I have enormous respect for him as well, because I think to have achieved what he's achieved, I have this phenomenal talent to kind of see it fade, not kind of, just to see it fade, and to remain yet essentially, and I think this is very important, a happy man is a huge triumph, because I've never met a mathematician like that. And I've met very few people who have had a sense of disappointment in their life who don't subsequently resent it for the rest of their lives. Simon somehow has managed to get through that, continue to fill his life with a sense of purpose and value, and to go out and do something he feels is socially important. Now, I have huge respect for that. So I think that's certainly why I want to maintain a friendship with him and would regard him as my friend, because he's someone I respect, who I feel has done something that's powerful and important. And also, I don't want to go in a teacherly way like this, but I feel it's instructive. I feel here's someone to emulate. And I like that about Simon, who is so without swagger about himself, so is essentially, he's not really modest in the sense that he doesn't sort of play down his capacities. He's just not interested in elevating or demoting them. He just is what he is. And it's a very refreshing person to be with, someone who you don't have to spend a lot of time interpreting what they really mean, because Simon will tell you what he really means, and then he'll get up and go off and look up another bus timetable.
Alexander Masters' biography of Simon Norton is called Simon, the Genius in My Basement. Jim Fleming talked with him. Now, before we go, I want to leave you with one more neighbor story from a listener. This one is a poem by Susan Avishai about the elderly woman who lived next door to her for more than 25 years.
Visit. I've come with strawberries because she used to grow her own, and they don't serve enough fruit here, she complains. I've come with stories of the neighborhood, which she spices from her salt box of memory. She has seen everyone come and go in 80 years, knows when each roof was reshingled, each tree put in. That fir was planted after the hurricane of 38 took down the maple, she says. I admit there were times I stayed indoors 10 minutes more so I wouldn't trip over her stories on my way out. I waited because I was rushed. She lived alone for 14 years after mother died. No longer did the nighties from the nursing home, lovingly hand-washed, dance in the breeze out back. They'd have ruined them in that laundry, she says. I tell her how many showed up when the house was put for sale. Earnest young couples with distracted toddlers. Now I'm the older next-door neighbor, not much younger than she was when we first came. She hopes we get nice people, adds it should have fetched more. I stand to leave, bend to touch the cool, creased cheek. The airless warmth has made me a little sick myself. I cannot talk. It isn't goodbye. Not yet, she says. Why do I weep all the way home to those abutting houses, both with tulips abloom, though hers stand bolder? She doesn't know I've stolen a trunk from her attic, put out last week as trash. I've dragged it indoors, the trunk her father took 4 years to brown, ought two to ought six. And when my door was closed, I opened it. Inside were mother's nighties, clean and folded. Why would you want those, she'd say.
A poem by Susan Avishai. She wrote it just a few months before her neighbor passed away. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. For more information about My Neighbor, visit our website at ttbook.org, where you can also browse through hundreds of past interviews with great thinkers, creators, and agitators, as well as some really great stories. If you want to know what's on our minds, follow us on Facebook or Twitter. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with help from Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, and our summer intern, Nayantara Mukherjee. The genius in our basement is executive producer Steve Paulson, and my neighbor in the studio is technical director Kirill Owen.
Please won't you be my neighbor. Welcome to this neighborhood, neighbor.
PRI, Public Radio International.